Okay, so Raim Tovim, good afternoon, good evening, Erev Tov and Alon Shvut, and welcome to everybody, which looking forward to an exciting series with an exciting teacher, Rabbi Alex Israel, to present a seven-part series on the thought, the writings and thought and books of Lord Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. Rabbi Israel has the distinct the credential that he grew up in England. So right away, that gives him an advantage and in. And I first met Rabbi Israel, I was talking on Shabbos to somebody back in 1994 when I was visiting on our way back from Israel, and we spent the Shabbos in Hendon and Golders Green, and you gave the shiur at the Bnei Akiva Minyan at Hendon. We didn't know each other, and you gave the shiur on Zman Hadlakat Neirot. And I remember the shiur. It was a very nice shiur many, many years ago. So it's a pleasure. We've had the pleasure of Rabbi Israel on Torah Moshe before. Rabbi Israel lives in Alon Shvut, where he learned in Yeshivat Haratzion. He got smicha from the Chief Rabbinate of Israel. He's a graduate of the London School of Economics. He's taught in many, many places. He teaches now, I believe, in Eretz Tzvi and Pardes, and he has written the Koran Tanakh series on kings. I think the second volume came out pretty recently. It did a two-volume series.
2 years ago already.
So, you know what? Time flies, especially COVID, you don't know. Okay. And anyways, a pleasure to welcome, and we want to thank the Gans family here in Toronto, the Gans Family Foundation, for their sponsorship of the series, Howard and Faye and Mary and Mindy. Thank you very much. And everybody be well. And we should come together for good occasions and to learn Torah. And Mavakasha, Rabbi Israel, it's all yours.
Okay, so hello, everybody. Good evening from Israel. And good day for everybody else who's in other parts of the world. And I'm delighted to be with you to share the writings of Rabbi Sacks, who I was privileged to know, and I'll talk a little bit about that shortly. And there's one big problem when you teach Rabbi Sacks, and that is I'm not him. Anything I can say, he could say better. Anything I could say, he would be able to, anything we wanted to say, he would be able to express. He was the master communicator in so many different ways. And therefore, when we're talking about Rabbi Sacks, I feel that I'm already at something of a disadvantage. And I think last November, we were all in shock at the sudden loss of Rabbi Sacks. He was such a key personality in the Jewish world, the master communicator, the master writer, a few years ago I was in LA and somebody was asking me and trying to think about a speaker for their shul. And he said, you know, I've got a 600 person shul. Who will be a speaker? And he wanted two things. Number one, I know that they will fill all the 600 seats in the shul. And number two, people will come out inspired. Who in the English-speaking rabbinic world can do that? And we had one name. It was Rabbi Sacks was the only one. Who else would it be? And we kept on trying to think more and more, and we were stuck. What I want to try and do with you in this course, and I'm going to explain a lot in the course of today, what this is really going to be a course, a seven-part course in Rabbi Sacks's writings. Today is going to be something of an introduction. But what we're going to try and do is go through some of Rabbi Sacks's major works and try and go through them one at a time. And in the course of the class today, I will explain how we're going to approach this. And today is going to be something of an introduction to who Rabbi Sacks is. I hope that what we're going to do is we're going to be able to put in all sorts of videos, because we do have the advantage. And I will say, if there's one silver lining to the loss of Rabbi Sacks, it's that he wrote over 30 books. He wrote countless articles. He recorded so much. He used technology so much. He embraced and loved technology. He has left a tremendous amount on the internet, which enables us to be able to continue to access his writings and his thoughts. And that's what we're going to be doing. And I'm actually going to start off with something maybe even surprising. I'll share my screen so that we can look together at the source sheet. But I wanted to start. I'm going to start off with something maybe a little light, a little put a smile on our faces. And you know why I'm doing this? I'm doing this because that's what Rabbi Sacks did. Rabbi Sacks believed in always starting with a little bit of humor and always starting with a bit of a joke. And this comes from a podcast, an interview with Tim Ferriss, who usually talks about economics. And Tim Ferriss asked Rabbi Sacks, he says, I wanted to start with perhaps unusual starting point, and that's asking you about your yellow ties. I found under the category of strange habits a note from your wife of 50 years that he always wears yellow ties when he's due to give important speeches. Is there any truth to that statement? And Rabbi Sacks said, 100%, Tim, I always used to wear silver ties. This kind of dignified thing that ministers of religion do. I had a huge, huge collection of silver ties. And then at a certain point in time, I'm not sure whether it was 2016 or a little earlier than that, the world began to fall apart. And that's when I realized that part of my job was not just to speak or to write, but to cheer people up. And I think little Mr. Cheerful has to be colored yellow. So I thought wearing a yellow tie cheers people up. And by and large, consciously or subconsciously, it does. However, I also do something else. I must have about 50 yellow ties. By the way, his daughter-in-law verified that for me. And when I'm doing a really, really difficult speech, I will wear a yellow tie that was given to me by a very close friend. My friends, noticing that I wear yellow ties, tend to make a present of a yellow tie. And when I feel I'm wearing something that a friend gave me in love, it makes the speech so much easier. So I wanted to share that because, first of all, it's a little funny, but it sort of shows the type of person that Rabbi Sacks was. He was meticulous. He took account of everything, even the fact that he was wearing a yellow tie, and also notice how he values the human relationships, which he made. And that's something which he felt gave him energy. And in a few minutes, I'm going to talk about that together with you. So what can we've all read piece. I assume there is no one on this call, and thank God there are 150 people taking part in this. I'm quite bowled over. I'm sure there is no one here who hasn't read something of Rabbi Sacks or hasn't heard a lecture from Rabbi Sacks. And maybe that's why you're here. But we're here to try and understand what was so special, what was so unique about his philosophy, and to try and encapsulate his philosophy. And that's what we're going to do in this course. And I want to start off by an analysis, which you'll find in a lecture. I probably should have put the URL together with you, but it's okay. We'll manage without it for now. An analysis by Dr. Micha Goodman, who some of you will know from Ayn Pratt or from Hartman. And he spoke about what was the chidush, what was the unique essence of Rabbi Sacks's thought. And he basically said it in two halves. And let me maybe try and analyze what he's going to say. Stage number one, if you want, what is the unique side of Rabbi Sacks? And I put it in this way. He gave Jews a new confidence in their Judaism. And let me maybe try and explain. Ever since the era of enlightenment, where people got freedom and we had a freedom in order to decide who we want to be and how we want to affiliate. I mean, let's think about it. Before emancipation, a Jew was a Jew whether he liked it or not. He wasn't invited into society. He wasn't allowed simply to exist as a citizen of the world. A Jew was marked by the world around him, whether that world was Christian or whether that world was Muslim, as a Jew. And frequently he spoke as a Jew and he looked like a Jew. And that's where he was. And suddenly the Enlightenment invited Jews to enter into the community of nations. And now the question is, why be Jewish? Why should I be Jewish? And in so many of his works, Rabbi Sacks tries to answer this question. And I would maybe say that one of the ways that he answers this is by telling us that Judaism isn't some ancient relic of a religion. Judaism isn't something which is 3,000 years old or 2,000 years old. He called one of his books, which is really a book for every young person and maybe every older person, and explains really why be Jewish. He called it Radical Then, Radical Now. In America, it was published as A Letter in the Scroll. Here you see it, A Letter in the Scroll. We're going to deal with that book in our next class, I think. But what it was called in England was called Radical Then, Radical Now. I imagine that he decided that in America, maybe radical sounded too radical. But in England, it obviously has a positive tinge. Judaism is radical. Let me try and explain. What he wanted to say was that Judaism has groundbreaking ideas, or maybe I'll put it this way. In the modern world, there are ideas such as freedom, right? Such as the idea of equality. And traditional religion isn't always associated with those things. Rabbi Sacks wrote Radical Then, Radical Now, and this was part of a whole genre of writing that he wrote to tell us, you know, those ideas of modernity, you know, those ideas of the Western world that we value, the values of freedom, the dignity of human beings, the respect for others. You think those are new ideas? We had them first. We're going to get those ideas from Sefer Bereshit. And he expresses these ideas of exactly how these ideas come out of the heartland of Judaism. In other words, showing us that we should have a confidence in our Judaism. And here I'll share with you one of the texts on the sheet. I'm going to already go to text number four. Text number four, if you will. And here we go. This is from his book, To Heal a Fractured World, which is a truly beautiful book. Let me just read a little bit with you and explain. He says this. In 1966, an 11-year-old black boy moved with his parents and family into a white neighborhood in Washington. Sitting with his two brothers and two sisters on the front step of the house, he waited to see how they would be greeted. They were not. Passers-by turned to look at them, but not one gave them a smile or even a glance of recognition. All the fearful stories he'd heard about how whites treated blacks seemed to be coming true. Years later, writing about those first days in his new home, he said, "I knew we were not welcome here. I knew we wouldn't be liked here. I knew we would have no friends here. I knew we shouldn't have moved here." As he was thinking those thoughts, a white woman coming home from work passed by on the other side of the road. She turned to the children with a broad smile and said, "Welcome." Disappearing into her house, she emerged minutes later with a tray laden with drinks and cream cheese and jelly sandwiches, which she brought over to the children, making them feel at home. That moment, the young man later wrote, changed his life. It gave him a sense of belonging where there was none before. It made him realize at a time when race relations in the United States were still fraught that a black family could feel at home in a white area and there could be relationships that were color blind. That young man, Stephen Carter, is now a law professor at Yale, and he eventually wrote a book about what he learned that day. He called it Civility. The name of the woman, he tells us, was Sarah Kestenbaum, and he adds she was a religious Jew. And he notes, in the Jewish tradition, such civility is called chesed, the doing of acts of kindness, which is in turn derived from the understanding that human beings are all made in the image of God. Civility, he adds, itself may be seen as a part of chesed. It does indeed require kindness to our fellow citizens, including the ones who are strangers, even when it is hard. What Rabbi Sacks is doing here is almost giving a modern iteration to the story of Avraham Avinu sitting at his tent. He's relating this all the way back to the notion of Tzelem Elohim, to the image of God in Bereshit. And what's he saying? those values, as he calls it, you know, to be colorblind in society, those values of equality that we have in society, those things that we value as part of our Western society, they are, and by the way, Rabbi Sacks loved stories. In that book, To Heal a Fractured World, it's Torah stories, Torah stories. He was the master of being able to weave in fabulous stories. But what is he basically saying? He's saying that you don't realize what a treasure you have. If you're Jewish, you have the original keys to the morality that we value in the Western world. It originates with us. Our religion is radical then, it is radical now. Same thing when he talks about Shabbat. He tells a wonderful story about doing a film with a social worker from England, and he goes into a Jewish nursery, a Gan Yeladim, on a Friday, and they're acting out Shabbat, and they're doing, and she goes to ask the children, what do you like about Shabbat? And one of the children says, I love Shabbat because it's the day when my father has time for me and he tells me stories and we sit together and all the week he's at work. And the social worker turns around to Rabbi Sacks and says, that Sabbath, it's saving families. Once again, what's Rabbi Sacks at? His first act is to give Jews confidence. Why be Jewish? Because Judaism, the things you value in the world, right? These are embedded into your tradition. Your tradition is a jewel. So that's the first side of Rabbi Sacks, if you want his side, which is the, should we call it the Jewish side, the true deep Jewish side. And we're going to talk about that in several of our lectures. Maybe let me say something about this and we'll return to it in our last class, in our seventh class. But I do want to say, before I talk about the other side, which is much more about Rabbi Sacks' exposure to the world, that Rabbi Sacks had a really deep, deep spirituality. He was a chassid at heart. He was a misnagad at heart. He was a chassid at heart. But, I mean, I remember watching him a few times when I davened with him. Him with his talus over his head, sometimes wearing his tefillin if I davened with him in the week, and feeling how incredibly deep his kavana was. He was really transported into another world. When he was first chief rabbi, they have a lovely show on the BBC, you can find it online, called Desert Island Discs. Any of you heard of this Desert Island Discs? So in Desert Island Discs, what they do is they interview you and you have to do your 10 records that you would, your 10 songs that you would take with you to a desert island. And Rabbi Sacks had a few different, later, by the way, I found out that he wanted to bring a song of the Beatles and people told him it might be inappropriate for the chief rabbi. But I think he put a piece of Chazanus instead. But one of the songs that he said, and when they asked him at the end, out of all your 10 songs, which song would you prize? If you had to take one, which would you take? And it was the Chabad Nigun, Samalacha Nafshi, the Nigun of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, which means Samalacha Nafshi, my soul thirsts for God. It's a deeply spiritual song. And he said at the end of this interview, if I had to think of one thing that I'd like people to say about me, which would be my epitaph, that people would say about me after my death, it would be this nigun, Sama Lecha Nafshi. And indeed, Rabbi Lionel Rosenfeld, who's a chazin and was very, very close and a close friend of Rabbi Sacks, sang this nigun at his funeral and said, this is what he saw at his essence, his burning passion for Hashem. Rabbi Shaul Robinson, the rabbi of the Lincoln Square Synagogue in New York, told a wonderful story that one Shabbat, Rabbi Sacks was the guest speaker at his shul. And, you know, you can imagine maybe he's thinking about what his drasha is going to be or how he's going to inspire the crowds. And he said, Rabbi Robinson said he was walking to shul together with Rabbi Sacks, and there are people running in front of them to try and get a better seat in shul to be closer to the front. And what's Rabbi Sacks saying? He says, are we going to sing in shul this morning? Are we going to get everybody singing? And when he gets to shul, he said, who's going to be the Baal Tefillah? He went up to the chazan and huddled with the chazan for a whole bunch of time. And he wanted to know whether the shul would be spiritual. He wanted it to be an uplifting spiritual experience. So The first thing I want to say, which is the core, one of the things at the core of Rabbi Sacks, is this intense desire to represent Judaism and to convince everybody that Judaism is radical then, it is radical now, and that the keys to the things that we value in our tradition are in fact already embedded. The keys that we value about our culture are already embedded into Judaism. Let me add one thing, and then we'll quickly move on to number two. Because what I want to say here is, actually, this is in a sense a perush to the Torah. Why? What do I mean? Because, of course, Rabbi Sacks was raised in the humanistic liberal tradition of philosophy and what have you. He is, of course, a child of his age. He wasn't an immigrant. He was born in England, went to the best British schools and universities. And in that regard, when you do look at his commentary on the Torah, or the way he read Judaism, he actually reads it in a unique way. He managed to draw out, because of his sensibilities in this sense, he managed to draw out all of that humanism out of the Torah, out of the Jewish tradition, things that people hadn't noticed before. And in a sense, this is his chidush, his ability to read Sefer Bereshit, Sefer Shemot, as having the real underpinning of tradition, of Western, of the best of Western society, was something that he was maybe more sensitive to than the average person. And in that sense, he gave a whole new reading to Sefer Bereshit, and we're going to be doing that reading together. Okay, so if the first stage is Rabbi Sacks, is, I said, after the emancipation, he explains why be Jewish, how Judaism gives us that freedom, gives us that equality, gives us all those things. That's all coming from our Judaism. Judaism is the most groundbreaking, the most modern that it could be. But here's the second side. And the second side is, of course, his exposure to the world. And what I want to say is like this. This is the idea that Judaism has what to offer the world. It's not that we gave Western culture, it's that maybe I put it differently. There's something wrong with Western culture, and Judaism has the answers to Western culture. And let me try and explain a little bit about this. Some years ago, I teach at Yeshivat Eretz Tzvi in Yerushalayim, wonderful yeshiva, and we were privileged about 10 years ago to have Rabbi Sacks speak in the yeshiva. And Rabbi Sacks gave a wonderful shiur about free choice, and then there was a question and answer session. And one of the students said to Rabbi Sacks, "You are the leader, probably the foremost figure of modern Orthodoxy. What are the challenges for modern Orthodoxy today?" Rabbi Sacks gave a sort of surprising answer. What can I say? We found it very surprising. Rabbi Sacks said, "I don't see myself as a modern Orthodox leader." And we're all looking a little puzzled. What do you mean? Who is a modern Orthodox leader if not you? You are the quintessential modern Orthodox leader. And he said the following. It was like quite amazing. He said, "If I define myself as a modern Orthodox leader," well, he said it's like this. "Jews are a minority of the world. Orthodox Jews are a minority of Judaism. Modern Orthodox Jews are a minority of Orthodoxy. Then I'll be describing myself as a minority of a minority of a minority. Who's going to want to listen to me?" He said, in fact, he said, when Avraham Avinu, and Rabbi Sacks always came back to the personality of Avraham, when Avraham Avinu was introduced to another tribe, the Bnei Chet, when he was buying the field of Machpelah, they described him as Nasi Elokim Ata B'tochenu. You are a prince of God amongst us. He says, I want to be a prince of God to the world. He said, last week I was in Emory University having a public conversation in front of 20,000 people with the Dalai Lama. He said, do you think I'd be there to represent the ideas of Judaism if I was just a modern Orthodox leader? No, I want to speak Judaism to a wider audience. I want Judaism to speak to the world. Now, of course, he could do this because of his voracious appetite for books. You know, Rabbi Sacks read his, I know this from his secretary, I'm very lucky that his personal secretary who ran his office for the last 20 or so years is my cousin. So I got a lot of insider access to Rabbi Sacks and a lot of information. She told me he reads at least a book a day, at least a book a day. A friend of mine had him staying at his house for Shabbos, and Rabbi Sacks said, I'm going up to rest for a couple of hours on Shabbos afternoon. And then he looked at his bookshelf and he said, could I take a couple of your books? And he took three books upstairs with him Shabbat afternoon. And then when he came down a couple of hours later for Mincha, he put the books back carefully back on the shelf. And my friend said to him, look, take them. You'll return them to me. Like, you know, if you want to read them, take them. He goes, I've read them already. I finished them. He could read a book so quickly. By the way, I was in a course with him when I was an undergraduate. And he actually turned around to us and he says, you've got to learn how to read. He said, I'll teach you how to read. He says, when you finish a paragraph, in your mind, summarize the paragraph. When you finish a chapter, in your mind, summarize the chapter. And then when you finish the book, summarize the whole book. And then you'll always remember it. Rabbi Sacks didn't realize that only his intellect could remember a book like this. We couldn't exactly do that. I actually have a practice of trying to do that, writing notes in the back of the book to do it. And even then, I don't remember the book. But he could. Now, this is what he said in an interview. He was at the Millennial Conference with religious leaders from around the world. And he says, there are 2,000 religious leaders here. What do I have to offer? He said, what do I have to offer? That I'm not only a religious leader. I was trained in philosophy and economics, and I can bring a unique fusion to the world. And that's why he wrote his final book, Morality, which is a masterpiece. I don't know if any of you have read it, but I'm sure many of you have. And what is his basic thing? If I said the first one was a message to Jews, be proud of your Judaism. His second message was that there are lots of problems in the modern world, whether it's loneliness, whether it's cancel culture, whether it's a breakdown in civility, whether it's a sense that people have lost meaning, whether it's the breakdown in the family. And what did Rabbi Sacks say? You think this world of freedom and equality is perfect? I've got news for you. He put a spotlight onto the Western world and showed all the problems of the Western world. And then do you know what he said? If you want to heal your world, I've got news for you. Religion can really help you. The religion which I'm part of, he really believed that there was diversity in the world. He respected that diversity, but that every group, and since he was Jewish, our Jewish, he says, we've got to talk loud as Jews and show how the beauty of our religion can make the world better. And that's why he was consulted by four British prime ministers. He tells an amazing story about how he's on the way back from Yitzhak Rabin's funeral, and he was on Prince Charles' private plane. And of course, what does a rabbi do on a long flight? Takes out a sefer. He says, I took out a Mikraot Gedolot and I'm learning. And he says, Prince Charles turns around to me and says, what are you reading? And he says, it's a Bible. He says, I've never seen a Bible like that with all sorts of paragraphs. That doesn't look like a Bible to me. He explained to him, here's Rashi, here's the Ibn Ezra, here's the Rashbam, here's the Ramban. So Prince Charles says, can I learn with you? Prince Charles, he said, stood in the aisle for an hour. He wouldn't sit down and learn. He said, I had a chavruta with Prince Charles. And he quoted a pasuk, Rabbi Sacks, from Tehillim. Va'abra neged malachim v'lo evosh. I will speak your Torah to kings and I will never be embarrassed. And his famous phrase, right, where he said that non-Jews are embarrassed by Jews who are embarrassed by their Judaism. Non-Jews are proud of Jews who are proud of their Judaism. Rabbi Sacks firmly believed that it wasn't only that Jews should be proud of their Judaism, but that Judaism had a message to the entire global community. And that's why he spoke on the world stage. I'll add one last thing. He wasn't afraid to really put himself there as a Jew. And when he was invited for the first and only time to speak in front of the European Union, he spoke about anti-Semitism. And he didn't pull any punches. He spoke to them about the oldest hatred and said, you've got a problem, guys, and you better solve it. And in that regard, he was unafraid lo taguru mipneish. So what I'm trying to say, there's the inward Rabbi Sacks. Why am I a Jew? And then there's the outward Rabbi Sacks. Rabbi Sacks, but again, coming from the core of his Judaism, through the prism of his huge knowledge. He'd read every book on sociology. He'd read every book on philosophy and remembered them all. And his magnificent ability to take ideas and, you know, hone them down to sound bites. But I'd like to maybe... I'd like to maybe say as a third point, a side of Rabbi Sacks that maybe people less know, and that is this. Rabbi Sacks was a mentor to so many people. Rabbi Sacks, and here I want to not talk about the philosophy of Rabbi Sacks, but I want to talk about the person of Rabbi Sacks. On the first Motzei Shabbat that Rabbi Sacks was chief rabbi, where did he go? He went to the local hangout, the pizza store, where all the 14-year-olds hang out, and he stood there on the pavement chatting to them. When Rabbi Sacks, after he finished being chief rabbi, he had a fellowship at NYU. And what did he do with his fellowship? Obviously, he lectured and what have you, but he used to tell the rabbi at NYU, the campus rabbi, every time I come, I'm going to give you a day. And I want you to fill my day from 8 in the morning till 5 in the evening with meetings with students. 20 minutes for every student. And he used to sit there. He never took a break, except for mincha, whatever it was. All he ate all day, he told me, was yogurts. That's what the rabbi told me. And people were allowed to meet with him, 20-minute slots all the day through. He wanted to meet with people. He wanted to meet with young people. He wanted to empower them. And this is where I encountered Rabbi Sacks personally. First, as a university student, he was involved in a project that he was involved with. And I at the time was a young madrich in Bnei Akiva, an undergraduate. And he always encouraged me. When I was a smicha student, I asked from his office for some time. I had a list of 10 questions to talk to him. I got half an hour. I had to send in the questions in advance. He didn't have time to look at them. And I spent precious half hour with Rabbi Sacks. It wasn't what he told me. It was the way he related to me. His secretary came in at the end of the half hour. And he said to his secretary, "Why are you spoiling my fun? This is my best half hour in my whole week to spend time with a young rabbinic student." And then he ripped out of his page in front of him, wrote on it, and handed me a little piece of paper. And he said, "Here's my home phone number, Alex. Anytime you want to talk about these issues, day or night," he said, "I'm an insomniac, I don't speak, call my home phone and I'd love to talk to you." I was 24. Do you know how I felt to have the chief rabbi say this to me? He made me feel special. You know what? Let's share some Torah of Rabbi Sacks. And I want to show you how he developed this in terms of his learning. I'm back to the sheet, and we're going to look at source number 2. Rabbi Sacks loved this Mishnah, and he spoke about it many, many times. The Mishnah says that Chamisha Talmidim Hayu Rabbi Yochanan Ben Zakkai. Yochanan Ben Zakkai had 5 students. Who are they? They were Rabbi Elazar ben Hurkanus, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Chananya, Rabbi Yossi HaKohen, Rabbi Shimon ben Netanel, Rabbi Elazar ben Arach. He says, "Who haya moneh shibcham?" He would count their praises. Rabbi Elazar ben Hurkanus, a sealed cistern that doesn't lose a drop. In other words, Rabbi Elazar ben Hurkanus had a tremendous memory. Rabbi Yeshua ben Chananya, fortunate is the woman who gave birth to him. Rabbi Yossi HaKohen, a chassid. Rabbi Shimon and Tanel, God-fearing. Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, k'ma'ayana mitgaber. And Rabbi Sacks says, this is in Pirkei Avot. Usually Pirkei Avot gives us instruction. But what are we meant to learn from this? And he said, it's very clear. He said, language can sometimes be descriptive. It can describe what we see. I see over there a tree. I see over there a bird. I see a river. He says, but language can also be creative. Language can be creative. He says, think about Rabbi Elazar ben, think about Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. He had five disciples, but what was he able to do to his students? He said to Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus, wow, look what an amazing memory you have. He said to Rabbi Yeshua, or Rabbi Yossi, you're a chassid, you're pious. He said to Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, you are an ever-increasing wellspring. You have tremendous creativity. And what did he do by doing this? Number one, he praised people. And Rabbi Sachs loved praising people. And what else did he do? He helped people create themselves. Because when somebody, imagine you're in school and you don't know whether to specialize in art or in maths or in English or in science, your English teacher comes to you and says, wow, you've got a real talent in composition. You're so creative. Or your computer teacher says, wow, you've got a real talent for programming. Suddenly you say, aha, I was a bit confused who I am, but now I have greater clarity about who I am. So Rabbi Sachs says that language is not just descriptive, it is creative. It raises people, and not only does it raise people, it is enabling people to find who they really are. And take a look at this from his covenant and conversation. I just want to share this with you. And then maybe what we'll do is we'll move on to explaining Rabbi Sachs's books and explain how we're going to organize the topics of this course. Let's just read a little bit here. He said, I discovered the transformative power of focused praise from one of the more remarkable people I ever met, the late Lena Rustin. Lena was a speech therapist specializing in helping children who struggled with stammers. I came to know her through a television documentary I was making for the BBC about the state of the family in Britain. Lena believed that young children she was treating, they were on average around 5 years old, and they stammered, had to be understood in the context of the families. Families tend to develop an equilibrium. If a child stammers, everyone in the family adjusts to it. Therefore, if the child is to lose their stammer, all the relationships within the family have to be renegotiated. Not only must the child change, so must everybody else. By and large, we tend to resist change. We settle into patterns of behavior as they become more and more comfortable, like a well-used armchair or a well-worn pair of shoes. How do you create an atmosphere within a family that encourages change and makes it unthreatening? The answer Lena discovered was praise. She told families who she was working with that every day they must notice each member of the family doing something right and say so, specifically, positively, and thankfully. So you have to turn around to everybody and say, wow, you did that, right? Well done. Thank you. That was really good for me. She didn't go into deep explanations, but watching her at work, I began to realize what she was doing. She was creating within each home an atmosphere of mutual regard and continuous positive reinforcement. She wanted the parents to shape an environment of self-respect and self-confidence, not just for the stammering child, but for every member of the family. So the entire atmosphere of the home was one in which people felt safe to change and help others to do so. I suddenly realized that Lena discovered a solution, not just for stammering, but for group dynamics as a whole. And my intuition was confirmed in a surprising way. There had been tensions among the television crew with which I had been working. Various things had gone wrong, and there was an atmosphere of mutual recrimination. After filming a session of Lena Rustin teaching parents how to give and receive praise, the crew likewise began praising one another. Instantly, the atmosphere was transformed, the tension dissolved, and filming became fun again. Praise gives people the confidence to let go of the negative aspects of their character and reach their full potential. There is in praise a deep spiritual message too, and here's Rabbi Sachs bringing it back. We think religion is about faith in God. What I had not fully understood before was that faith in God leads us to have faith in people. For God's image is in each of us. We have to learn how to discern it. I then understood the repeated phrase in Genesis 1, and God saw it was good, was there to teach us to see good in people and events, and by doing so, help strengthen that goodness. A fundamental lesson of leadership. It doesn't matter whether they believe in you. What matters is that you believe in them. So, wow. What Rabbi Sachs is saying is that there is tremendous, tremendous praise. And this, you know, maybe what we'll do is, well, hold on 1 second. I want to maybe say something about where Rabbi Sachs got this from. Rabbi Sacks, when you sat in front of him, again, what can I tell you? The last time I had a meeting with him was September, a year before he passed away. And I went with him to actually to give my second book to him. And I went with him to ask him a bunch of questions. And I had all my questions and I finished all my questions. And then what did Rabbi Sacks turn around to me and say? He said, Alex, what can you teach me? What can you teach me? I'm like, he said to me, help me. He said, what's going on in Israel that I don't know about? Tell me about a book that I don't know about. Tell me about a teacher that I don't know about. Sure enough, I told him about a book and a teacher. And the very next day, his secretary, my cousin, was on the phone to me. What was that name of that book? Who's the teacher? Rabbi Sacks wants to order it, right? He knew how to make everybody feel that they mattered. Now, where did he learn this from? And here I want to share something with you. 1 minute, just going to find the right video. And I want to share a video with you, which is where he's going to explain about his teacher and where he learned this from. So just 1 minute. Here we go. This is a story about the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Here we go. I hope you'll be able to hear very well.
The first took place in Toshin Chof Ches in 1968. Toshin Chof Zion, Toshin Chof Ches, when I was a second year student, a sophomore at university. I'd already encountered Chabad because Rabbi Shmuel Lu and Rabbi Feivish Vogel visited Cambridge. They were among the very first to go out to university campuses, and I was among the very first beneficiaries. Then came that summer, 68, and I came to America to meet great rabbis of the day, and everyone, every single rabbi I met in America said, you must see the Rebbe. You must see the Rebbe. So I went to Eastern Parkway, 770. I came in. I said to the first person that I met, I'd like to speak to the Rebbe, please. He fell about laughing. He said, do you know how many thousands of people are waiting to see the Rebbe? Forget it. I said, well, I'll be traveling around America. Here's the phone number of my aunt in Los Angeles. If it's possible, phone me. Weeks later, I was in Los Angeles, came Motzei Shabbat, the phone went, it was Chabad, the Rebbe will see you on Thursday. Now I had no money in those days, and all I had was a Greyhound bus ticket. Have you ever ridden from Los Angeles to New York on a Greyhound bus? 72 hours nonstop, I sat on this bus, I came to 770, and eventually the moment came when I was ushered into the Rebbe's study. I asked him all my intellectual, philosophical questions. He gave me intellectual, philosophical answers. And then he did what no one else had done. He did a role reversal. He started asking me questions. How many Jewish students in Cambridge? How many get involved in Jewish life? What are you doing to bring other people in? Now, I hadn't come to become a shliach. I come to ask a few simple questions. And all of a sudden, he was challenging me. So I did the English thing. You know, the English can construct sentences like nobody else, you know? They can construct more complex excuses for doing nothing than anyone else on earth. So I started a sentence. In the situation in which I find myself, and the Rebbe did something which I think was quite unusual for him. He actually stopped me in mid-sentence. He says, nobody finds themselves in a situation. You put yourself in a situation. And if you put yourself in that situation, you can put yourself in another situation. That moment changed my life. Here I was. Here I was, a nobody from nowhere, and here was one of the greatest leaders in the Jewish world challenging me not to accept the situation, but to change it. And then, that was when I realized what I've said many times since, that the world was wrong. But I thought the most important fact about the Rebbe was he was a man with thousands of followers. They missed the most important fact that a good leader creates followers, but a great leader creates leaders. That's what the Rebbe did for me. And for thousands of others, friends. That particular episode had an
idea. 1 minute.
I was due to leave the States, go back to England on my trip.
Okay, I hope everybody could hear. This gives you a sense of how Rabbi Sacks viewed one of his formative experiences and gives also a sense of how that impacted him. By the way, that was a trip he made in his second year of the summer after his second year in university, where he went out seeking different rabbis. He met Rabbi Soloveitchik, he met the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and those two made the greatest impression upon him. I see in the chat that somebody has asked me if we can just do a very, very quick biography. So maybe I'll just quickly say, Rabbi Sacks grew up in a traditional home, a shul-going home, maybe a typical Anglo-Jewish, what we call United Synagogue home, not a particularly religious home, not a particularly learned home, but they went to shul every Shabbat. And when he went to university in Cambridge to study philosophy, he found himself, you know, really excited to, and we'll talk about this next week, to engage in the universalism of university. And the things which really turned him were 1967, the Six-Day War, where suddenly everybody was so frantic and so scared about Israel. And he realized, wow, you know, how is it that there are hundreds of Jews who I've never seen in the Hillel in Cambridge, but are coming here to pray, to find out news? He realized it shook him to his core. Something about Judaism and his Jewish identity. I can't just be a student like everybody else. I can't just be a British academic. There's something going on here, which is something to do with my Jewish identity. Then the very next year, as he was developing his Judaism more, he decided to go and visit these rabbis in the United States and met the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who challenged him to stay in 770. And if you follow that video through, I've given you the URL. It's a fabulous speech. He stayed for a month in Chabad in New York, and this really transformed him. Rabbi Sacks continued with his philosophy studies, but later on decided that he was actually going to study for the rabbinate. And he, in fact, got two smichas. His main influence in learning was Rabbi Nachum Rabinovich, who first was a rabbi, if I'm not mistaken, in Canada, and then later moved to London as the head of Jews College, and finished his career, just passed away actually a year before Rabbi Sacks, but finished his career as the Rosh Yeshiva of Ma'ale Adumim, an expert in the Rambam. I know from people who were in Jews College at the same time as Rabbi Sacks, they say that Rabbi Rabinovitz had a whole share, but really only one student. And that was Rabbi Sacks. Rabbi Rabinovitz's son told me there was not a day that Rabbi Sacks did not call the house with one question or another. And they had a remarkable relationship. Rav Rabinovich gave him smicha in Or HaChaim, and he went to another kollel in London to get smicha in Yoredea. Interestingly enough, as with many great leaders, Rabbi Sacks had a unique education because he never really went to a traditional yeshiva. He spent a bit of time in Kfar Chabad in Israel, but he found it too oppressive. He didn't like the yeshiva life. And in that regard, he was really one of a kind because he forged his own way. Later on, he became a rabbi of the community in Golders Green, Dunstan Road Shul. And while he was there, he already started lecturing in Jews College, where he eventually became the head of Jews College. Not only that, but he set up all sorts of things. He set up an organization to try and give confidence to young rabbis. He set up a journal called the Ela to start an intellectual conversation in Israel. And from the youngest age, he was actually, really dynamic and continually coming up with new ideas. He did his PhD when he was already lecturing in Judaism, in philosophy. And he did his PhD was done in King's College in London, under the late Bernard Williams. And it was actually about his theme of his was about responsibility. It was about hocheach tocheach, the mitzvah of rebuke, but analyzing it from a philosophical and legal standpoint. He became the head of Jews College and was lecturing there, as well as being communal rabbi, and then was appointed to chief rabbi in 1991. When he stood down from being chief rabbi at age 65, he set his sights on really affecting, as I said before, Nesi Elokim Ata B'tochenu, working throughout the world. Yeah, I mentioned before Prince Charles was the guest speaker at his retirement from chief rabbi. And Prince Charles turned around to him and said, "We were born in the same year. We were both born in 1948. He said, "And you are now retiring at age 65. And I haven't yet started my job," he said. A great line. Anyway, that's a very quick. Rabbi Sacks wrote 30 books. He had 18 honorary doctorates. You know, who didn't he talk to? Who didn't he advise, right? He wrote speeches for Mike Pence. He met with the Pope. Where wasn't he? Who didn't he speak to? I'm going to share the document again, because what I want to do is explain a little bit about his literary output and his books. And let's take a look. What books did Rabbi Sacks write? Now, this might be a slightly intimidating page. I'm going to make it a little smaller. Here are his, how many? 37 books. 37 books, okay? Now, by the way, notice his first book in 1986 was a translation, an adaptation of the Sichot of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, which shows what an influence the Lubavitcher Rebbe had on him. But what I want to do is I want to try and sort out, we're going to be accessing Rabbi Sacks through his books. So I want to try and make some sense here. So let's try and do that. Everything that you see in blue is a traditional liturgy. Look, the Haggadah, the prayer book, the Siddur, the Koran Sacks Siddur, the Rosh Hashanah Machzor, Yom Kippur Machzor, Pesach Machzor, Shavuot Machzor. So we can take all those out, right? Those are, I mean, they're not, take them out. They're fantastic. But everything in yellow are his commentaries, his covenant and conversation, his weekly commentary on the Torah. So let's take those out. We'll spend our seventh class looking at some of those a little bit, but essentially there's that. I put two in gray here, number 11 and number 15. Those are transcripts of his media, what he wrote for the Times, that Celebrating Life were pieces that he wrote in the London Times. And number 15, From Optimism to Hope, a collection of his BBC Thoughts for the Day. There used to be a thought for the day just before the 8 o'clock news in the morning, and Rabbi Sacks was asked to do that several times. So those are those. So what's left, okay? What's left? So what's left is what you'll see on page 5. So let me try and see if we can group them, and this will help you into terms of understanding what topics Rabbi Sacks was interested in addressing. The first books is earliest books. I hope people can see this. I'll make it maybe a little larger. His first set of books from the late 80s and early 90s was really about understanding the Jewish world in the 20th century. He was very bothered by the way, many of his books talk about the word crisis. He was worried about the crisis of Jewish unity. Was the Jewish world fragmenting? So his first book, called Traditional Alternatives in the UK, in the US it was published under the name Arguments for the Sake of Heaven, was basically, Rabbi Sacks was always the great summarizer. He could take huge processes and condense them and explain. So what does he do? He takes the entire Jewish world from the emancipation. This was the first book that made me fall in love with Rabbi Sacks. I read it as an undergraduate. And he took us from there and he explained, why are there Reform Jews? Why are there Haredi Jews? Why are there modern Orthodox Jews? Who are all these groups? What's the difference between, I don't know, British modern Orthodoxy and American modern, and Rabbi Sacks and Raphael Hirsch? He went through Zionism and explained why it had to be. And really mapped out the entire Jewish world. Another book he wrote, Tradition in an Untraditional Age, right? I'll show you the title page of this book just so that you can, 1 minute, sorry, we'll get there. I Just need to change my screen. Let's see if it... Oops, 1 minute. It's not... Okay, I can't... Unfortunately, for some reason, it's not... Let's see if I can do this again. Ah, here it is. I will share it now. So this is the page of his book. Look what it does. It goes through Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, Rabbi Rav Kook, Rav Soloveitchik. Okay. He's going to talk about it. If you look at the bottom, Martin Buber, the Holocaust in Jewish theology, Dilemmas of Modern Orthodoxy, Jewish Christian Dialogue. He's going through in that book so many of the problems, the questions of modern orthodoxy. So this is what he goes to in his first books. His books are One People, Tradition, Modernity, and Jewish Unity. Okay, so that's what he's trying to address. These are the issues he's trying to address at the beginning of his career. Crisis and Covenant Jewish Thought after the Holocaust, really thinking as a modern Orthodox thinker. That's one set of books. Another, we're not going to go into that literature. We're not going to go into those books in this particular course. Sorry, it's just too much to go through. And we're going to start with number two, which is the questions of why be Jewish. Sorry, there should be a question mark there, and the Jewish future. And here, his book in 1994, which he wrote at the beginning of his chief rabbinate, Will We Have Jewish Grandchildren? How do we make sure that we have Jewish continuity? And in fact, he set up an organization called Jewish Continuity, and A Letter in the Scroll, which was going to be the topic of our class next time. Another book he wrote, Future Tense, A Vision for Jews and Judaism in the Global Culture. Again, what is the future of Jews and Judaism? And in fact, there he talks about Medina Israel, the future of Medina Israel, and we're going to do a class on that book as well. The third area of his books is The Place of Religion in a World of Religious Violence. And here we're going to see his book, The Dignity of Difference, How to Avoid the Clash of Civilizations, written, as you can see, in 2002, after 9/11, after the fall of the World Trade Center, where everybody saw religion as a source of friction, as a source of violence. And he says, how can we avoid the clash of civilizations? And in 2015, Not in God's Name, when we have a hearing about ISIS and religion is seen as such a divisive, his friend, his book was called Not in God's Name, and the subtitle, Confronting Religious Violence. Okay, so that was another topic. And we're going to do a class on Dignity of Difference, which was his most controversial book, and talk about the controversy behind it. A fourth topic, God, Science, and the Search of Meaning. He took on the evolutionary scientists and he said, called it the Great Partnership, and he said, looked at modern science and saw modern sciences in such opposition with religion. And he wanted to argue with the great evolution. He didn't take easy topics, right? I always think that Rabbi Sacks, you know, had originally wanted to train as a barrister, as a court lawyer. And he, as a teenager, loved being in the debating society. He sometimes took the most difficult topics. I mean, to take the topics of the place of religion in a world of religious violence, who takes that on? Who takes on the whole world of some of the most strident scientists, Dawkins and this one and that one, and says, I'm going to show you that what you're saying has a flaw in the argument, but Rabbi Sacks did it. And the last topic he takes on, the topic number five, secular society and modern morals. From 1991, the persistence of faith. From 1997, the politics of hope. From 2007, the home we build together. And from 2020, restoring the common good in divided times. He was passionate about the fact that he felt that the modern secular world was flawed, that there was growing loneliness, growing depression. There was alienation. Families were falling apart. And he really felt he had a message for them. Number six, The Role of Chesed. And this is his book, To Heal the Fractured World. It's a Musar book. It's unbelievable. And last, of course, all of his Jewish books, on the Chumash, Sidur, and Haggadah, and the Chagim. So what we're going to do in each class is we're going to talk a little bit about these different books and try and see what we can make of them. Now, I hope you don't mind if I go over a tiny bit over an hour, because I want to share with you something which is quite significant. One of the questions is, why did Rabbi Sacks write so many books? Why did he write, I knew from his secretary that he used to sit down every summer and write a book, okay? Every summer. In fact, when he used to meet me, he used to say to me, Alex, where's your next book? What are you going to write about? And I once said to him, Rabbi Sacks, we all don't get, 6 weeks off every summer to write a book. What I really meant is we can't all write a book in 6 weeks. But I said to him, and he looked at me with a sense of indignation, and he said, I don't get 6 weeks off. I take 6 weeks off. And why did he write so many books? In fact, I'll say something even more than that. I've been rereading a lot of his books in order to prepare this course. And I read The Politics of Hope, which is from 1997. And then I read his book from 2020 called Morality. Between you and me, they're the same book. They've got exactly the same structure, more or less the same argument, and exactly the same thesis. One is an update, of course, with 23 years in between. And I raised this question to some of my colleagues, and I asked them what they thought of this. So one of them said, he's a rabbi. The rabbi might give a sermon about Lashon Hara this year, and he might give a sermon about Lashon Hara next year, right? In other words, whatever he felt was the most burning problem, how did he do it? He wrote a book about it. And I want to share with you why he decided to write books. So let me share with you what he had to say about this. This is from a lovely interview with an organization called The Tortoise. And it's called The Tortoise because they say we think slowly like a tortoise. And they have things called think-ins, where think-ins are to enable people to think together. And in this think-in, somebody asked a question about demagoguery, and this is happening in the time of, Trump and all sorts of leaders who are, and he's trying to explain why he writes books. Listen to this video, and he'll say something very interesting that he once said to me in a private conversation. Let's listen to this.
Hugh's had his hand up, and the others as well. So you first want to take a clutch of a run.
My name is Robert Mindell.
Is it Robert, did you say?
You made a fascinating point earlier about inequality by citing the Disney CEO Bob Iger's remuneration and CEO pay ratio in excess of 1,000 to 1 of the median. But obviously the reality of that is that there are a huge portion that is deferred share options and long-term incentive plans. I'm not here to defend a pay ratio that's definitely in excess of that JP Morgan ratio you cited. But isn't that evidence? And the audible gasp in this room hearing that was even more fascinating, because it shows how the nuance in arguments can be lost. We are in search of morality and in search of justice. Campaigners are in a sense, we are seeing too much distortion of facts, distortion of truth, distortion of what is the reality. We are losing that nuance, whether it's that campaign group trying to seek workers' rights among large employers, whether it's seeking for environmental justice among large companies who are polluting. But as an individual, and I'm not going to say consumer, you get lost in what you trust, because whoever shouts loudest, whoever makes the most scaremongering argument ends up being the one that is most forceful. And is that not danger for morality in society?
Yeah, of course. I'll tell you exactly why I write books. See, when I was a kid, I learned to speak in public. And in those days, I mean, not anymore, but in those days, I could do it quite well. I could really move a crowd. And I thought that was the most dangerous thing I knew. Because you can move them to truth, but you can move them to falsehood. You can move them to love, but it is a lot easier to move them to hate. You can move them to feel threatened. You can move them to paranoia. I cannot begin to tell you how easy it is. And it made me ill. I still speak publicly. It's what I do. But I thought, I am not going to do this any longer as the carrier of what I have to say to people. I'm going to set it out in print with sources, with footnotes, with qualifications, wherever I feel it appropriate, and say, here it is. Now, I'm not trying to persuade you of anything. Just read it on your own and tear my argument to shreds. That's why I wrote the book. And that is the difference between what the Greeks used to call philosophy and sophistry. And that's why I write books.
Okay, so that's why he writes books. He writes books because he wants to put his argument out there. And even in an interview, you know what, if you don't mind, if you can just bear with me, I want to share one other interview, okay? And one other interview that they had with him where he's asked by Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg of Boca Raton Synagogue, and he's asked about whether he ever confronted any difficulties, and he writes about his difficulty in writing. You know, in one of the Hespedim, in one of the eulogies for Rabbi Sacks, one of the Dayanim in the London based in, suddenly I'm blanking on his name, said that when Rabbi Sacks was writing his PhD, he asked him, how's it going? And he says, I think I'm writing in a style that will be absolutely unintelligible, with a complete smile on his face, right? Because that's what you have. Diane Eyenbinstock, thank you very much, Arthur Stein. Diane Eyenbinstock said he was proud to talk in an academic, unintelligible way. But Rabbi Sacks trained himself to speak in a more and more and more clear way so he could engage with people. And if you will, just listen to a few moments of this other interview with Rabbi Sacks. Sorry, there's no visual here, but we'll play this, and with this we'll sort of like finish off, because I want to share with you what he has to say here. Listen to this.
It's okay to ask a personal question.
Yeah.
When we look at the chief rabbi's life, we look at the chief rabbi's productivity, whether the trajectory of ascending to chief rabbinate, publishing 30 books, 17 honorary degrees, being named a lord, all of this seems that the entire life has been filled with success after success after success, triumph after triumph. Have you ever experienced failure? Have you ever
experienced failure?
And what gave you the tenacity to persevere?
I nearly failed my first degree in my first year in university. I nearly failed my second year in university. I was turned down for virtually every job for which I ever applied. I wanted, since I was a kid, to write a book. And I started at the age of 20, and I gave it every spare minute of my time. Even when Elaine and I went to a concert somewhere, I'd be writing notes during the interval, or during the breaks between movements in a symphony. And for 20 years, I failed. From 20 to 40, I had a whole huge filing cabinet of books I started and never finished.
What changed?
What changed was I happened to be reading the George Bernard Shaw's preface to Plays Unpleasant. And And it opens, if you're going to write a book, write it by the time you're 40, or forget it. And I thought, Mina Shamayim, you know, somebody's telling me something, because I don't know why I happened to open that bit of that writer. So I thought, that's it. This is it. This is my last chance. So I wrote my first book at the age of 40, and a book a year ever since.
Wow.
I failed for 20 years. I failed at almost everything. So, and incidentally, Winston Churchill put it beautifully. He said, success is going from failure to failure without loss of enthusiasm.
And that was...
Sorry, 1 minute. Okay. So on that note, what I've tried to do today has been to give something of an introduction to Rabbi Sacks and the impact he has and the style of the way he expressed himself. And what we'll be doing, and also to an introduction to his literary output, because, you know, the way we're going to access this is we're going to take one book at a time. And my idea today was to sort of try and bring him alive, explain a little bit about his personality, but also a little bit about his impact. And Be'ezrat Hashem, from next time, we'll take each time a book. We're going to be doing quite a bit of reading. For those who want a bit more personal biography, if you look at the sheet, I didn't even get onto the last places of the sheet, but I put about 6 different stories that Rabbi Sacks himself told about his own life. So you can read them in your spare time. I'm not going to manage to get to those books, to those stories. And I look forward to meeting you again for the next few weeks and slowly going through Rabbi Sacks' writings. I think we're going to see many of his ideas will be life-changing for us and will be very, very enlightening and informative. So thank you for joining me. And thank you. It's lovely to see such a large community here learning together. I want to thank Rabbi Kelman and Torah in Motion because...
You froze just as you're thanking Torah in Motion.
Oh, thank you very much. I don't know how I froze.
That's
thank
fine.
You very
no,
much
that's
to Torah in Motion.
Bracho, you know, so.
For all the wonderful, wonderful programs you put on. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Really, thank you. Thank you. A pleasure. Halavai, I should be a failure for 20 years like Jonathan Sacks was.
Exactly. Okay. And all of us. Amen.
You know, but anyways, really, thank you for that wonderful introduction. We look forward to seeing you next week. Just very quickly tonight, Mark Shapiro is going to be finishing up his book, 30 Years Correspondence with Rabbinic Figures. Tonight is what wasn't included in the books, the letters he didn't include and why. So this is the uncensored version of the book, I guess. Tomorrow morning, Rachel Sharansky continues her series on the kings and storytelling. Simi Peters on Wednesday at 1 p.m. and Dr. Sokolov, the Doctor of the Week. Thursday, Shuli Mishkin's back for her tours of Israel. And Thursday night, Rabbi Yossi Adler of Rinat Israel, Rinat in Tinak will be our guest Parshat HaShavush here. And Friday morning, my Parshat my Pirkei Avot here, 9:30 Friday morning. And we look forward to learning with you. And please invite a friend and to join us. And please, God, next Monday, before Rabbi Israel's class at 11 o'clock, Shira Mervis will be starting a 6-part series on Sephardic Psak Halacha. And we'll send out the more details as we go along. But that's, please, God, will be next Monday, starting at 11 a.m. and then 12:15, Rabbi Israel's back. I don't know, Rabbi Israel, you're frozen. I don't know if you're still here, but thank you very much. And we look forward to learning with you next week. And everybody, have a wonderful day. And those who can make it this evening, 8:30, we'll see you then. And be well, everybody. Erev Tov. Yom Tov. Erev Tov. Laila Tov.
Erev Tov.
Okay.
Erev Tov.
So Erev Tov are the people who live in Israel, right? Is that how it works? And that's
good afternoon from
I'm sorry?
How can we get the source sheets?
The source sheets are posted already on our website. They were posted in the chat box. They're go to the Torah Motion website and you'll see it under the program. You know, each individual program has its own program page. And then the recording will be there later also. You can listen to. But all the source sheets, that's where we record them always.
It was fantastic. Just fantastic. As always, Rabbi Kalman. Fantastic.
Okay. I don't thank me. Thank Rabbi Israel.
And Rabbi Israel was fantastic. Oh, my gosh.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.